The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast. Before we get going with the podcast, I just want to thank you for all your years of listening to the many episodes here. You know, this is a passion project for me over the past few years. I love interviewing the guests that we have on here, hearing their stories of how they broke into the industry. It is so unbelievably valuable. And to keep this going and really to improve upon the podcast, what I've done is I've started a Patreon page. If you go to patreon.com/MWFP, that's M for Master, W for Wildlife, F for Filmmaking, P for Podcast, then you will find my new Patreon page. Now, Patreon is somewhere where you can subscribe and join the world of Patreon and the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Patreon community. What does this do? Well, it brings some money in to help me make these podcasts because they do take time and money to produce. But also, what they do is they allow you to get bonus content from behind the scenes material to who the upcoming guests for the next few months are, to other things like being able to choose who you want on here, ask questions to the upcoming guests, and even get extra content like catch-up conversations where I go back to previous guests from the past few years and I find out what they've been doing since I last spoke to them. Patreon is a great way to help support your favorite creators, favorite podcasts and videos and YouTubers and you name it. And basically what you're doing is you're donating to help me keep these podcasts going and also to get that bonus content. So please head over to MWFP and see if there's a tier there. They start pretty cheap and there's various tiers for various levels. Check it out. See what you can do. If you can do anything at all, I would very much appreciate it to help me bring these to you in the future. But the other thing is, what I want to do is I want to get to a level where I can bring you more of these. Currently, we've just been doing them one a month. And I would love to do two of these a month, but it does take a lot of time. So many of these guests are so hard to track down and actually get on a call. You know, the last few guests, actually this episode, Barend and Henk, I took months to get them on the podcast because they were always traveling the world and in places where they just couldn't jump on a call. And then also the one coming up after that, again, it's someone who I've been trying to track down for months and months. So it does take a lot of time, energy and effort to do these. I'm sure you'll agree it is well worth it. And the podcast isn't going anywhere. This is just something to help make it something more, make it more sustainable. And if we can, let's try and get you some more episodes. Let's try and do 24 of these a year instead of just the 10 to 12 that currently I'm doing. So thank you so much. I appreciate it. Let's get on with our new sponsor. I do have a new sponsor for the podcast, which is of great help. So let's get on to our sponsor and then on to this month's podcast episode. This podcast is proudly powered by Battleborn Batteries. Let the power of lithium take you on your journeys across the outdoor world. Battleborn Batteries is the industry's top choice for lithium-ion batteries. Reliable, safe, and long-lasting, Battleborn makes the sustainable and lightweight drop-in replacement for traditional lead-acid batteries. Are you ready to make the switch to lithium and switch to green energy? If so, all batteries are in stock now, and you can shop today at battlebornbatteries.com. You're listening to the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, episode 38. From an early age, Barend knew his life had to be one in nature. After school, he obtained a degree in photography and then proceeded to study nature conservation. He started his work career in the Kruger National Park in South Africa as a game ranger and guide, and so obtained valuable insight into the life of the natural world. The end of 2004 marked the start of his filmmaking career as a wildlife cameraman, when he was granted the opportunity to work for award-winning National Geographic filmmaker Kim Wallater. He worked on numerous productions for National Geographic, Animal Planet International, and various other broadcasters. Since, he has also worked for the IUCN and Wildlife Conservation Society. Over the years working with Kim Wallater, he mastered his skills as a natural history documentary editor, cameraman, and producer. In 2015, Barend started producing natural history films of his own, with Rooted being his first series he produced and filmed, along with his life partner, Henk Eckermans. The five-part series focused on the secret lives of some of Africa's most iconic trees and the life they support. Rooted won numerous awards around the globe and 19 worldwide nominations. Work has taken Barend to various countries like Botswana, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Swaziland, Namibia, and Gabon. And over the past year, Barend has also traveled and filmed extensively in Chile, Peru, and Mexico for a new nature series. Henk developed a love for film at a very young age. And to achieve his dream of becoming a successful filmmaker, he went to study at the South African School of Film, Television, and Dramatic Arts, where he graduated with honors, specializing in editing. He won the award for Best Editor and also taught editing in his final year at the AFDA. After graduating, Henk started his career editing drama, working as head editor on two South African TV drama series for KYKNet. He also worked at Gasworks for a while, expanding his horizons as an online editor. In 2008, his travels to the rest of Africa began, when he was commissioned to edit a reality series in Zambia. Since then, he has been lucky enough to work on different projects across Africa, in countries like Nigeria, Kenya, Ghana, Tanzania, and Niger. From there, his career only grew as he worked for companies such as Rapid Blue, MTV Africa, Masters and Savant, Urban Brew, Underdog Productions, Aquavision, Launch Factory, Lucky Bean Productions, to name just a few. He has edited documentaries, reality series, commercials, corporates, music videos, drama series, and wildlife and short films. Apart from being an accomplished editor, Henk is also a gifted storyteller and a talented graphic designer. Good evening, Barend and Henk from South Africa.
Hi.
How are you guys doing this morning?
Great stuff. Great
this morning
stuff.
For me, well, this evening for you.
It's evening, yeah.
Very good.
Very Thanks. Good. Thanks for having us.
Hey, thank you so much for taking the time out. I know you guys are super busy right now in the middle of the throes of post-production. So although it's the evening, I think Henk is probably writing scripts through the night, so I've heard.
That's right. Never stop writing.
There you go. Awesome. Yeah. Well, as always with these podcasts, what we're going to do is get into the kind of career background, how you guys got where you are. Barend, we'll start with you and then we'll move to Henk. But Barend, tell me, what was it that led you down the path of wildlife filmmaking?
Well, as a kid, my parents always took us to the Kruger National Park, which is our biggest national park in South Africa. And from a very small age, my love for nature just started. And then I always knew I wanted to be somewhere in nature, whether it be like a game ranger or a conservationist or that kind of thing. And then in 2013, when I was like 13 years old, I saw a documentary about Derek and Beverly Joubert and their life as wildlife filmmakers, but also conservationists. And that day I decided that is what I want to do. So since then, through school, subjects that I chose, things that I learned was driven towards where I am today. So after school, I went and studied photography. So I got a degree in still photography because I couldn't afford to go to film school. And then after that, I did a degree in nature conservation because I felt that I needed that understanding of how nature works to be able to become a very good wildlife filmmaker. And then after that, after university and all of that stuff, I worked as a game ranger in the Kruger National Park for a few years. And then basically I took a chance one day and emailed Kim Walliter, which you've interviewed before.
Yes, yes.
And said, listen, this is my passion. This is really what I want to do. If you ever need an assistant or a volunteer, this is my details. Please contact me. The next day, Kim contacted me.
Fantastic.
And said, listen, let's go for coffee. 2 weeks later, I started working for Kim. So I was his camera assistant for probably about 7 or 8 years, doing lighting, because a lot of Kim's work at that stage was nighttime work. We worked on productions for National Geographic called Predators at War, Hyena Queen, those kind of things. But during that time, Kim also said, here's a camera, start filming. And he said, okay, His daughters, which were like really small, 6 and 4 at that stage, came out to the bush to visit him over weekends. And he said, just start filming us and see where this goes. And I did that for probably a good 5 years of just Kim and the girls going out with him filming every night. And we got some golden stuff about them. And it eventually turned into a 6-part series for Animal Planet.
That's fantastic.
So that was my first sort of solo thing. But also Kim said, you are going to edit that. And I had no idea about editing film. So he gave me the Final Cut 2 manual, which was like this thick, and said, there you go. So what I know today about editing and color grading, I taught myself. And it's literally and that I think is the beauty of this industry. It's a constant learning process.
Yes,
because technology is moving the whole time. There's new techniques coming out and you have to stay on top of the game. So for me, that was like, in a nutshell, where everything started, and Derek and Beverly Joubert that inspired me.
That's great. I mean, it's great on so many levels. One, you were inspired by really who I like to call the king and queen of wildlife filmmaking.
Absolutely.
And then that you understood that there was not only a need to understand imagery, whether it was stills or film, you chose stills, but you understood there was a need to understand natural history and to do those two different things. And I think so much that is forgotten these days is that, you know, because gear is now not, you know, the stopping point for us. It's not the barrier to entry. The people get their gear and they worry about the gear and, you know, how am I going to film this and do this? But they don't worry about actually learning about natural history, conservation.
Exactly. And that's actually one of the most valuable lessons I learned from Derek. He said, you can actually be the best cameraman in the world, but if you do not understand your subject and the natural history, you can forget about making a film.
100%, yeah.
And it is so, so true. So for us, whenever we go out in the field, we spend months researching our subjects so that we understand and know what to expect. Because otherwise, you're just out in space, basically.
Yeah. And we should add to that you did do a degree. It doesn't mean you have to. I never did a degree. I was lucky enough. I grew up on a wildlife park and I was self-taught. Yeah. But it is a case that when you take something on, you just do everything you can. Like you say, you take months in advance to research, spend time in the field before you film, just understand your subject so that when you put a camera in front of it or in front of you, and you know, you have an understanding of what you're going to get and how not to interrupt that behavior. That's fantastic. And obviously, you know, working so many years with Kim, what a experience. And
oh, absolutely.
And it just goes to show that, you know, you wherever you are on your journey, there's always something to learn, right? It never
stops. Yeah, absolutely. I agree.
Hank, let's move over and find out about your career path. What was it that led you along this journey?
Well, believe it or not, I actually didn't want to become a wildlife filmmaker. I wanted to be an actual movie maker, a feature filmmaker. So I wanted, my dream was to make movies. So after school, I went to study film at AFDA, the African Film and Television Drama School. I was there for about 5 years and I got 2 degrees. After that, I did a lot of drama series and eventually landed in reality TV. That I got caught in for about 20 years.
that's a big catch. 20 years.
Yes. And after a while, I decided I did not want to do that anymore. One of the shows or places I worked was Aquavision, where I did reality TV wildlife. And that's where I met Barent. And
that's actually the funny story how our paths actually crossed.
Right.
We did a show for National Geographic called Caught in the Act. And we were both editors on the show. But I was living in Cape Town and Henk up in Johannesburg. So I would do a 3-month stint and then my contract would end and Hank would take over. And we did probably, 3 seasons?
Yes.
Like that, just taking over from each other. And then one year, Hank said, listen, we always work on the same show. Let's just go for coffee. And the rest is history.
Excellent.
So,
fantastic. So Caught in the Act. Tell us a bit about Caught in the Act that you guys worked on.
Caught in wildlife the Act based. It's wildlife based. So basically what they did is the research team at Aquavision found all these videos like on YouTube where people caught, just filmed like on their cell phones or a little mini DV camera, amazing events that happened in nature. And then they get experts in to explain some of that behavior. So it's a clip based show. And they did many, many seasons of the show. So there were reenactments and sort of natural history built into those sort of YouTube type clips.
Sure.
To explain actually how these animals behave in a natural way and why this actually happened. So yeah, that was actually very, very interesting.
So you guys were basically editing the footage that was coming into you. So Hank, what other you said you were in the reality world for 20 years. What other shows were you working on?
Well, basically anything you can think of. I did Got Talent. I did Strictly Come Dancing, X Factor, all the South African versions of those shows.
Right.
I did a lot of reality TV shows in Central Africa, a medical show called Healthline, which ran for about 6 seasons.
Yeah.
Anything you can think of, basically.
Yeah. So what was it then? So you were 20 years, you met Barend editing on Caught in the Act for Nat Geo. What was it then that you said that you had had enough of that and you wanted to do something else? What was the kind of turning point?
Well, when we met, I basically got Barent into the reality TV scene as well. And he did it for a couple of years and he hated it. He hated it from, was not wildlife.
Yeah.
And I also had enough by now.
I've been down that road too. I know that feeling.
We did one particular show, a South African based show. I won't mention the name.
Right.
With a really bad producer, and I said to Henk, "Enough. Yeah. Enough is enough. We and need to do our own thing."
That was the tipping point for both of us, and we said, "Okay, let's do something, create something that is ours, and we don't have to work for someone else anymore." Let's get out of reality TV.
Yeah.
So basically, we came up with an idea for Rooted season one, and I wrote a treatment. About a 30-page booklet of information, what it's about. We went into the Kalahari and filmed a promo, and we sent it to a channel in Canada, and that was it. They immediately accepted it.
What I'd love to know, because so many people ask about this, so here you are, you've got backgrounds in TV, Barend, you'd filmed with Kim, so you had a natural history background. Henk, you were kind of there, just coming more into that side of things. But at that point where you're writing your treatment and you're putting your sizzle together, explain the elements that you got for that, and did you understand exactly what you needed? Because I think there's so many people who don't have a clue. And, you know, networks require different things. Some networks don't want 30 pages. They want a page and a half, or a page, or 2 pages.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly.
So what was it that gave you an inkling to what you had to put together?
So for me, because of all the years that I've worked with Kim, he had enough trust in me to involve me in a lot of his pitching processes.
Great.
So that gave me an understanding of what was required. I come from a family of accountants. So budgeting for me is like, I do it every day. I know how to do that. I know how to cost stuff. But these days, you will not be able to sell a project without, for instance, a sizzle reel. They want to see visually what your idea is, what your creative approach will be. And like you say, some networks require like a one pager. Some networks really want a lot of detail. And I said to Henk, okay, let's do both. We do the one pager, but we also go into full detail, who the crew is going to be, what the creative approach will be, what the synopsis will be. And for Rooted One, we initially only pitched it as a 1 hour show. But then when we pitched it to Blue Ant, and when they saw the treatment, they said, they really like this idea. Let's do six episodes.
Mm-hmm.
And we said, oh, okay. And then the research started. So we were
pitching it to Blue Ant as a co-producer, or as for their...
As a commission.
As a commission as a for commission. Their... Yeah, for yeah. their channels. Yeah.
Yeah. yeah. So, and then basically did all the research, sent it to them. They loved it, and we signed the contract.
And I didn't have that background that Barend had about what to do. I had different background. So I had I studied writing. So we complemented each other well, because he basically told me, we need to do this, and I wrote it. So
yeah. I'm not a writer.
See, that's fantastic. When you've got the right, you know, partner to be able to do that stuff with, and you match so perfectly, it's essential, right? Because otherwise,
absolutely.
You sit there. I'm a terrible writer as well, but I write. You know, I don't sell many shows because I'm a terrible. No, you know, it's one of those things. You just have to. You have to work really hard on all these things. And so, if you've got those different avenues, that's great.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wonderful. No. So tell us about where Rooted Series 1 went, how well it did, and where that led.
So Rooted 1, like I said, Blue Ant was sort of the main commissioning company, but they brought the Smithsonian Channel in as a co-producer. So the two of them distributed, basically it's showing all over the world.
And Blue Ant also said, because it's our was our first production as producers, we have to get mentors in that would kind of guide us. So we got one of my friends actually is the, was the assistant for Derek and Beverly, funny enough.
Yeah, that's correct.
And we showed the trailer to them and they said they want to do this.
Yeah, so Derek and Beverly were actually the executive producers on Rooted One.
Oh, wonderful. So that must have been incredible for you.
It was incredible. We were so grateful for them. They guided us and helped us along the negotiations and all of that stuff. So, yeah, that was phenomenal. So, and then when, I mean, that was a, we filmed, so that Rooted One was a 5-episode series focusing on 5 of the iconic trees in Africa.
Now,
we filmed that.
And I was going to go into that, and I made a note of these just so we get an idea. Tell me if I've got these wrong. I've got rock fig. Is that one of the trees?
Yes.
Yeah, rock fig, yellow wood, sausage tree, acacia.
Yeah, correct.
Camel thorn.
Yes.
All right.
And so the baobab.
And the baobab. The baobab. Right, so the acacia is a camel thorn. Is that right?
Yeah. Correct.
Yes, okay. So this is really interesting because I had a question come up with my mentoring group the other day, and I mentioned you guys because the question was about, I have one of my members is filming a lot of inanimate objects, right? And they're struggling because they're in a place, and I can actually, I'll say his name because I'm sure he'll be listening to this. It's Rasmus. And so Rasmus from Sweden. And Rasmus is filming a lot of inanimate objects. And his question was, how do you bring these things alive, right, on camera? How do you do that?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, I'm going to be speaking to a couple of guys who have done a lot of that. Although they've got a lot of wildlife in there too, they're filming a lot of trees. So run us through what you do to bring a tree to life before you bring all these other kind of, you know, characters into it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, a tree is a static subject, never mind all the birds and insects and stuff that live in the tree. You can't just show a static shot of a tree. People will get bored. So I said to Henk, for me as a director of photography, we have to bring movement into every single shot. We will not have a static shot of a tree in any of these episodes. So you use like cable cameras, you use obviously a lot of time-lapse, motion control time-lapse, sliders. I mean, we put sliders and stuff up in the trees.
I've seen a few of the pictures on your website and I think on Instagram where
just anything to bring that element of movement in. And to show close-up detail and that kind of thing. So,
and as from a storyteller's point of view, you have to make the people relate to the tree. So you make them kind of create characters for the tree so people can relate with them.
Through how you do that with a tree, creating a character for one.
Well, a tree has character already. You just have to look at it in the right way.
Yeah. I mean, some tree species, for instance, are male and some are female.
Right.
So that already gives you an element to work with to give it some sort of a personality. And also sometimes the tree might be very old, it might be still very young. So with the script writing, we play a lot with that to make it again relatable to people.
That's also assigned
personal characters, personalities to the tree, like an old lady for the acacia tree and a majestic giant for the yellowwood tree. So
the sausage each tree was the Casanova,
was the seducer.
So tell us about some of the other characters, because there's a lot of wildlife in here, right? You're really going through the whole life cycle of, you know, all the other wildlife that's involved around the tree. So tell us about a few of the most special characters and the ones you had most fun filming?
Oh, man.
Well, you don't actually realize how much living creatures are around trees until you sit underneath one.
For
I think for the camel thorn, the sociable weavers that build these enormous nests was one of the highlights.
Because ants,
the
right?
nest, sorry?
Weaver ants?
Sociable weavers, the little birds.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah. So they build these massive grass nests. And the nest is constantly evolving. And that is actually a huge element in that episode because that nest weighs nearly a ton.
Wow.
And especially when it rains, it becomes even heavier. So sometimes it causes damage to the tree, the branch break or some part of the nest break off or that kind of thing. And they just such endearing characters. We had lots of snakes and reptiles. And
With the sociable weavers, we filmed the Cape Cobra actually climbing into the nest, or climbing the tree and into the nest, which was... Wow.
That was a huge highlight.
So looking at a scene like that, right, is that expected? Were you expecting that behavior?
Yes, actually, we that was in our treatment and we were hoping to film that.
But the thing is, you wait.
Right.
You wait,
and that was going to be my question. How long from getting there, expecting that behavior, other than going and getting yourself a cobra and putting it in there, how long did you have to wait?
The way we film these episodes is trees change throughout the year. So every single tree we filmed in every single season. So Rooted 2 took 2 years to film. Rooted 1 took 2 years to film.
Yeah.
So we went to the acacia, summer, winter, spring, autumn. But then you're there for like 3-4 weeks at a time and you're at the tree basically every day. And if you're lucky, maybe just one day that snake will arrive.
That happened on the third time we went.
Yeah.
So
that
was way into that second year. It was a while before we found that behavior.
And that's wildlife filmmaking, right?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And the beauty of it is we both shoot. So one of us will cover like long lens, one will cover wides, vice versa. And we all obviously constantly communicating.
Yeah.
So all angles are covered. So no one misses anything, basically, which is a huge help.
Tell us a little bit about what you were shooting series one on.
We actually filmed that on the Sony FS7s, which were really, really great cameras. We use a lot of Canon glass. I'm a huge Canon fan. I don't know if I'm allowed to say that.
Oh, yeah.
But so I love Canon. The Sony FS7s really, really performed super well, especially in the Kalahari with that heat.
Yeah.
We actually had no issues with those cameras.
Only issue we had was me spraying it with bug spray, which was... idiotic move, but
it kept the bugs away. But did the camera stop working?
It worked, but the paint on the camera is no more.
So you now have a limited edition silver version.
It's a camo version right now.
That's fantastic. That's probably worth some money. You know, you could sell that on eBay as the original camera from Rooted Season 1.
Absolutely. On Rooted 1, we probably filmed about 70 terabytes worth of footage, which was quite a lot. But that's for all 5 episodes. So.
Yes.
But
you're going back every day through these seasons of a trip. I mean, and you've got to be rolling on something, right? I mean, well, tell us a bit about that. If you head out there on a day, are you, once you've got establishing shots of that tree, let's say on the first day, or however long it took you to get your establishers and doing all of those shots, what would you then do as you go back? Would you literally set up and just wait for some behavior? And would you pick your species as well that day?
Yeah, so what we do, we basically draw up a wish list of a specific stint. So let's say we go to the Acacia and it's spring. We know that this is going to happen. Let's get our tree establishers out the way.
Yep.
And then we sit and wait for either pollination or animals coming to feed on the flowers or whatever the case might be. But also we shot establishing shots every day because every day the weather is different.
Yes. Yeah.
Whether there's clouds or whatever. So we would head out like 4 o'clock in the morning, be at the tree when it's still dark, get sunrise time lapses, drone shots, all of that stuff. And then once it sort of warms up, get animal behavior stuff, whether it's insects or reptiles, and then in the middle of the day when the light is really bad, go back to camp, dump the cards, log late afternoon, same thing.
Yeah.
So
I mean, it almost feels silly not to do that when you're there and you know you're going to wait anyway, right? You might as well film and get some more in the bag, right? So would you log on a daily basis when you're filming that much material? Are you logging to know, hey, this is different because
absolutely.
Because I'm the editor, I log everything and I go through every single bit of footage and type a very detailed list of what we filmed that day. It just helps me in the end to put the story together.
I mean, great, you being the editor, being there filming, you know, it means that you get what you want when you're in the edit suite, right?
Absolutely.
As opposed to hoping that the producer or the camera person is doing good logging. So that's fantastic.
And also, you know, by sort of towards the end of a stint, oh, but we still need that. Let's go shoot that. So we actually ticked off a lot of stuff on our wish lists as we go along, which really,
it was
really
actually
helps.
A really smooth shoot most of the time.
Have you any idea how many species that were you initially found and put in the treatment or ended up filming?
Goodness. It varies. So the Acacia episode was probably the most varied episode species wise.
Yeah, and the baobab.
And baobab, yeah. Because there we had numerous birds and obviously the larger animals. So the place where we filmed the Acacia episode, there were no large mammals like elephant and those kind of things. But the baobab episode we filmed in Zimbabwe. And there were elephant and buffalo, lion, all of those big things.
Nice. Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I would say on average, we would have close to 30, 40 different species. And that is from the smallest and to the biggest mammal and birds.
Yeah. I mean, that's an incredible amount to film to get behavioral. Yeah. I mean, it's hard enough to pick one species and go out and get behavioral shots of you know, unique behavior.
So that's our biggest challenge, to get proper sequences, because you have to focus on so many things. So one day you just say, okay, today we're filming elephants.
Right. And I was going to ask you that. Did you have any situations where you said, okay, today it's elephants, but then you know, another animal came in and did something so incredible.
Absolutely. It happens all the time. Your plans go out the door many a day. So,
right. Yeah. Right. And were you guys, I mean, close enough that you could just talk to each other, or are you on walkies or something?
We're on walkies most of the time.
Yes.
But when there's like dangerous animals, like in Botswana and Zimbabwe, we always stayed close to each other.
There were lions and elephants.
I mean, in Botswana, where we filmed the sausage tree episode, the grass was 2 meters tall.
Wow.
So, and we would often be like on our haunches filming stuff. And the
filming
one day,
a great spider scene, and you're so caught up with, you don't know what's going around you. So an elephant can walk right past you and you wouldn't know it.
The one day we were working and we always park the car like quite a 100 meters away, so that if we film drone shots, there's no tire tracks around the tree. And We finished for the morning, got back in the car, and literally 50 meters from the car were two male lions sleeping. So that was quite, nerve-wracking.
And you guys, you know, someone like the Kruger, you were allowed in there on your own based on probably your history with the Kruger?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, the thing is, in the Kruger National Park, national parks in South Africa is incredibly difficult to film in.
Yeah.
You're not allowed to drive off-road. So we didn't film in Kruger at all.
Oh, okay.
No, we didn't film. And also, it's quite expensive to film in national parks in South Africa.
Yes.
So we normally approach sort of private reserves or smaller reserves that from people that we know or whatever, that kind of thing.
Gotcha, So you're able to be out there on your own. The first series I ever filmed, I ever hosted, was actually in the Kruger. It was show on insects in the Kruger National Park. And Dr. Leo Bruck, are you familiar with
Dr. Leo?
Yeah, Dr. Leo Bruck came out with us. And we had to have multiple, you know, rangers come out with us for everything you're just saying, you know, so we knew where we could go and what.
Well, if you go and film in Kruger today, it'll be the same.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, you're not allowed to go unoccupied.
Sure,
there's always someone with you. So
So and obviously the good news is, I think we can say that you are you're now in the post-production phase of Rooted 2. Which is fantastic.
That's
I know
great.
We can't talk much about it, but I'm sure it's got some trees in it.
absolutely.
It does.
I mean, we spent the last year in South America for season two. Obviously, with COVID, it was a little bit difficult to travel. It caused many, many delays for our first departure. But it happened and we got the footage in the bags,
which is an incredible life experience,
which is awesome. And of course, with filming, like we've been talking about, you know, there's always issues. It doesn't matter if, you know, you head out, it's either the weather, the environment, people, the animals, something, the equipment, there's always something that's going to go wrong, right? And then a pandemic comes along. So what was the timing from, you know, your production phase of heading out into the field and the pandemic happening?
So we got the green light for Rooted 2 in, I think, end of May 2020.
Oh.
Yeah. It's so weird. It's 2022 already.
Sure. Well, that's right when everything was kicking off, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, and we got the green light in May. But then South Africa and probably most of the world was in hard lockdown. We could not leave South Africa. There were no international tourists or flights in or out. And then we only opened again, I think, in sort of mid-October.
Yes.
And then we could only start making plans. But by that time, obviously through email, thank goodness, we could organize everything in the meantime. So all our teams on that side were on standby.
Great.
And then in November 2020, we finally departed and started our work.
So six months later, you had a six-month delay. And then, you know, November, certainly over here, was still an unbelievably tough time. So how did you circumnavigate the shutdowns around the world and the lack of flights and things like that?
Oh, goodness. So,
in the first place, there's no direct flights to South America during COVID. So from Africa.
Yeah.
So we had to fly to Europe first and then America.
Yeah.
So that's very long. It's long haul flights.
It's a 3-day trip to get to South America.
And this is an interesting budget question. So obviously when things like that happen, typically there's contingency built into most budgets, but did you have a contingency for that or did you have to absorb that extra cost?
Well, the thing is we had to absorb a lot of that into the budget.
Yeah.
and I can't say too much about that sure. at the moment, but there are allowances now for any sort of COVID-related expenses. Because obviously we signed before the whole thing started really taking shape. But yeah, it really ate into the budget, all the flights. And the one thing, for instance, is we planned to go and then come back to South Africa, go again. So we actually planned to come back to South Africa during the whole year three times. And then we only came back once in the whole year. So
we basically got stuck there.
We
I
got
think
stuck.
I remember this because I think we were due to do this sometime around then.
So we decided we will not come back to South Africa because South Africa again was on the red list. And if we're here, we won't be able to get back that side, which will cause enormous delays for the production. So, yeah, we just decided we're staying that side, continue with the work and get it done. So I'm glad we did. So
absolutely. And you know, being able to make those decisions yourself and say, you know, this is what we got to do. This is our baby, right? I mean, this is your project that you've put together from the onset. It's series two. It's done well. You're now on a different continent. You know, and you can make those decisions and say, hey, this is for the best of the production. Because so much of the time, productions can be so convoluted and you don't have that choice. Someone else is making those decisions for you. And then, you know, I was on a production that was a large-scale production. It got shut down and it that's the end of it because it's just too much with COVID.
I must say that the channels that we're working with were so understanding about the whole COVID thing and it causing delays and that kind of thing. They were actually remarkable. And we had full support from them. So,
which is
that
what
was
you need. That's
really,
great.
Really great. Yes.
So, series two, can you tell us a bit about gear? Have you changed your arsenal of gear for this one?
We have. The thing is,
you need a second plane for the gear.
So, with Rooted One, obviously we could drive everywhere because it was literally driving distance. Sometimes it's a 2-day drive or whatever. With Rooted Two, it wasn't that easy. So our excess luggage. So this is the crew. This is Henk and I. That's the crew.
And we should actually say, so Barend, you are camera person, producer, director.
Yeah.
Henk, camera person, writer, editor. Wow. Yeah. So yeah, there you go. All right.
Yeah. So we do everything in house.
Who gets the coffee?
He doesn't drink coffee.
Oh, okay.
So basically when we traveled with 20 pieces of check-in luggage.
Wow. Yeah.
And then, because we're living in Africa, you cannot check in gear. So all our valuable gear, lenses, hard drives, computers, we carried on our person. So we probably did a total of 25 flights over the past year.
Right.
Just
to get your gear backwards and forwards.
Well just to travel between the countries to get the different seasons.
Sure.
But not once, thank goodness, did they weigh our carry-on luggage.
Ah.
Because between the two of us, our carry-on alone was 80 kilograms.
Wow.
80. Yeah.
Right.
So we had backpacks, and when you at the check-in counter, you stand up very straight.
This is the lightest
bag is not heavy. We traveled with a lot of gear, but we changed our gear. We're now shooting on red because I wanted. So I do the color grading and the onlining process as well. And I wanted the raw capabilities of the footage. for high dynamic range delivery and all of that kind of things. We scaled down on the cable cameras, for instance, because of travel. Yeah. We can't take the enormous one. Gimbals, that kind of thing. We also use smaller sliders just to make it easier for travel. I'm actually amazed our sliders never got lost during flights, because it's the most awkward thing to check in. But I'm super, super chuffed with the reds that we actually filmed on. And,
what type was it? What flavor of red?
It's the Dragon X, the 6K version.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, so we filmed 3 episodes and we ended up with about 160, 160 terabytes worth of footage.
So it's not relatable in terms of the first series, because Red files are so much larger.
Oh,
so
absolutely.
It's probably lot less footage than you actually had in the first one.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. So
and then did you find that, did you lose any of the the style and the quality of the first with the gear you were able to have? Did you manage to achieve the same standards with the lesser gear you had?
I think we actually upped our game a lot.
I agree.
We added like wide angle macro lenses. The Venus probe lens, for instance, didn't exist when we did season one. I think definitely visually wise, season two is going to be way better. We've got some incredible stuff.
That's amazing, isn't it? That as say you didn't take some of your biggest gear and suspending cameras and doing that, and yet you've come away with better gear.
Well, that's actually one of my favorite things in the world to do, is to research gear and design gear. So before we even left, that 6-month delay that we had before we could leave, I started designing stuff and then 3D printing stuff.
Oh, wow.
So that we could, for instance, mount cameras in trees or camera traps or that kind of thing. 3D print, it's small, you put it together, when you're in the field, off you go.
That's fantastic. That's being a camera person or producer, doing your own thing, but a filmmaker, you've got to be resourceful like that, right? I mean, I think all of us at some point have built, I mean, back in the day before we had electronic gimbals, I would be building gimbals from water pipe and weights, from weight training gear, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
All the good old-fashioned stuff and pipe, plastic pipe support systems and all that stuff.
No, exactly.
My first dolly was made out of two 2-inch waste pipe.
And
it had roller blade. It had these angle brackets with roller blade wheels on.
Uh-huh.
And it sounded, that was the first thing.
No, exactly. You have to be resourceful. You can't buy everything. It's just insane.
Loves doing that kind of stuff. I would walk into the house and he would be building some sort of crane out of a tripod and an extension.
That's awesome. Yeah. So let's move on to advice for people, because you guys, I mean, it sounds like you've done a bit of everything, right? You've had to be resourceful. You've had obviously COVID to work through, which is, I think, the hardest thing that anyone on any production has had to deal with. But what was so fantastic is you were still able to do it, because I know so many productions around the world got shut down. And just couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone? Let's start off with people who are starting out in the industry, right? First of all, like you guys early on, looking to get your foot in the door, what would you say is the best piece of advice for people in that situation?
I would say, that's just me, and that's I'm falling back on the way I started. Mm-hmm. Get your natural history knowledge if you can. For me, that is absolutely vital. When we went to South America, now I was thrown into the deep end because I did not know the specific animals, But again, we research that. So get your wildlife knowledge if you can, and then go out and shoot. Whether you're shooting with your iPhone, a small DSLR, practice. That is the biggest thing. There's always something out there. And that's one of the biggest things why we chose to do Rooted. And I'm not dissing anyone filming big animals. There are a lot of films out there about big animals, which are really important, but we want to make people stop and look at the smaller stuff as well.
Yeah.
Go look at a tree. There's always an insect or a bird or something that you can film.
Yeah.
And study it, stay with it, because if you stay and have that patience, you're going to see something remarkable.
Well, and I think, you know, with what you guys chose to do, there's advantages and disadvantages. The advantage it being that you don't have to find massive amounts of behavior from one species, right? You're building, it's the building blocks of all these different things.
Exactly.
But the disadvantage is you've got to find that behavior of all those different things, right?
So those specific little things.
Yeah, it's a lot to do, but exactly. Fascinating. Hank, how about yourself? Advice for people looking to break into the industry.
It's very similar than what Warren said. It's just get up and do stuff. I mean, don't sit and think you have to, this is my dream. Pick up a camera and do it.
Yeah,
that's the only way to learn. Also, the technical stuff, a little bit of education would help. Warren studied photography, I studied film. Those backgrounds did help us in the end. So
no, definitely.
For
definitely.
Me.
And also at the end of the day, there's so many people doing what we are doing, and they are more than willing to help. People can reach out to us and say, listen, when you guys are going out into the field again, may I join you? And we would gladly accommodate you.
That's awesome.
Come spend a day, a week with us, see what we're doing, ask questions.
I can be over in the morning. That's awesome. I mean, that's what's so nice about this industry is it's very small. It's, you know, everyone knows everyone pretty much. And and it's not like, as you say, the reality based stuff where, you know, you are just another person here, there being, you know, and there's a lot of demands, but where this is more controlled, I think, and more friendly. It's a more friendly environment as an industry.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, that's what I found, because Rooted One was the first film festival we entered was the Missoula Wildlife Film Festival. In Missoula.
Yeah.
And we went to that festival, and just meeting everyone in the industry face to face was such a joy.
Yeah.
To see how friendly they are, to see that there are people that they are struggling like you, to hear their stories.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah. You were supposed to be there, but you had your foot in a cast.
Yeah, that's right. I broke my leg. Yeah, that's right. I was due to be on a panel. That's right.
Yeah,
so that was 2018. Yeah. And I got hit by an elk, believe it or not.
Oh my gosh.
I was filming actually on an FS7, and I had it down kind of on my hip, knelt down on one knee. It was 12 degrees in Fahrenheit, so it's below freezing. We're on this frozen riverbed in the middle of nowhere, just outside of a canyon. A helicopter's dropping these elk off that they've just net captured, and you know, it's just one of those things. We're all there. I'm the only person on my knee. All the biologists are right behind me. This one elk, female elk, as she went to get up, she slipped on the ice. Spun round and just ran at me, and not being vicious, or you know, she's just running away, and she hit me in the front of the camera and the shoulder, and as I rotated round, my leg was so planted on the ground I snapped my own leg with the weight of my body. And then I was 3.5 hours before a helicopter could get in to get me out. That was the fun part. But that, and I think Missoula was literally, Missoula, Montana, or the International Wildlife Film Festival in Missoula, Montana, was a month later. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
and I was doing pretty good at that point, but it was, they told me not to fly. They basically said, don't fly. Yeah. I couldn't drive. So, you know, I was on crutches. And yeah, so I couldn't be there, yeah. Which was a shame because it would have been nice to meet you guys in the flesh.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But
exactly.
Next time. So it'll be interesting to see what happens. One last thing before I let you guys go. As well as advice for new people in the industry, you guys, you know, you were in the industry for quite some time doing your separate things before you did your own projects. And I think there's a lot of people out there like that too, who are in positions but would love to do their own thing. What kind of advice might you have for someone like that who's maybe having to look at leaving a paid position to then pursue, you know, putting their own things together?
Yeah, I think it's quite a difficult one. My advice would be to try and get to a wildlife film festival and meet people. Meet some of the executives. The executives of the channels, they're always willing to chat. Every wildlife film festival I've been to, chat to the people. They're willing to listen to you. Just make connections. So, yeah.
I would never tell someone to stop their current job to pursue a new career because that's just too risky for me. We didn't do that. We basically took off 2 months to kind of prepare our treatments and our trailers.
True.
And then we sent it off. After that, we continued working.
Yeah.
Well, that's great advice. Yeah. Right there.
Yeah. I have your backup plan in parallel with your dream, and once this one takes shape, you can drop the other one.
But you need to take that 2 months off to kind of prepare
to really do it. Yeah.
And put in the time. The thing is, this is not a 9-to-5 job; it's a lifestyle. We often work till 11 o'clock at night, but like you said, it's our baby. We need to nurture it. 5 o'clock in the morning, you're up, you're starting the renders, kind of thing. So, yeah.
And of course, it's, you know, it's different parts of the production, right? Pre-production, you are writing, you're trying to get that sizzle together. But then there is waiting time, right? If you don't have parallel projects running at the same time, then you might have a few months to wait. You know, there's always that period of will it and won't it. I can imagine the most frustrating thing for you guys is probably getting the green light right entering into lockdown. Must have been such a anti-climax.
It was agony. It was really, really hard. But
But it worked out.
The thing is, use that downtime to prepare. And for me, I'm always learning. I'm always studying. I'm always doing courses, whether it's a course in film business management or stuff like there's so many online resources. So use your downtime to learn. Because no one can take that knowledge from you.
Yeah. And I think in this day and age, there's so many more resources all the time. We're moving to a virtual world. Virtual learning is where it's at so much of the time. For ongoing learning. And there's no excuses from that point of view anymore. You can always be learning something new.
No, definitely. I totally agree.
Guys, thank you so much for taking time out of your evening. I know it's probably pretty,
thank you.
Pretty late there in South Africa, but I appreciate it. Where are you guys now? Are you in Cape Town? Are you in Johannesburg?
Johannesburg.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, well,
it's supposed to be summer, but we have not had summer. It has been the coldest summer we've had in many years.
It's it's a funny year. We're having more snow here right now than we've had in a decade, which is good. I mean, it should be doing that. But it's certainly showing some different signs, which is good right now. So we'll keep our fingers crossed. But thank you again. Pleasure to have you here. And we'll all look out for Rooted 2.
Thank you so much.
And until next time. Thanks, guys.
Thank you. Have a good one.
If you've enjoyed this episode of the Master Wildlife Filmmaking Podcast, then please leave a rating and a comment. And remember to subscribe to keep up to date with the series' future episodes. You can find out more information about wildlife filming at jakewillers.com. And if you're interested in starting a career in the wildlife filmmaking industry or being mentored to further your career, then please visit jakewillers.com/mentorship. Thanks for listening.